Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be getting into the news in just a moment with Cyber CX's Adam Boileau, and then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor guest. He is a listener favourite. It's Haroon Mir. Haroon, of course, is the main dude behind Thinkst Canary, and he's joining us today to have a very Haroon-style conversation. We'll be talking about how security controls and detections often fall over when things happen that are, when things take place outside of our assumptions. Trojan software updates, for example, attackers hiding in unconventional places like monitors, things like that. That's coming up later. It's a very interesting conversation. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, the Washington Post is reporting that the United States government, the Biden administration, is considering imposing sanctions against Russia. And the vibe I get from this story is that these sanctions aren't really about just one thing, but cyber is definitely a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a bunch of stuff going on in Russia at the moment, and they cite, of course, the poisoning of Navalny as one of the things that is of concern. But yeah, it does make good headlines when you bring up the SolarWinds thing. And, you know, well, there's been a lot of discussion about norms in the cybers and sending messages and deterrence and signaling and all that kind of thing. And, you know, clearly there is some desire to, you know, show Russia that they can't just go around hacking everything, even though everybody else also goes around hacking things as well. And yeah, whether or not sanctions are an effective tool against Russia in, you know, the context of cyber stuff, I guess we don't really know. But they're, of course, also using the lines about there being things that we'll see and things that we won't see.
Yeah.
We had a few weeks ago about that came to mind.
Yeah, no. I mean, look, there's a couple of interesting things here, I think, in this story. It seems like the US administration would do well to focus on criticizing Russia's means here, not necessarily their ends. And that seems to be, reading between the lines, the problem that they have, right? Which is like, get your hands off our supply chain. You're making people nervous. And I think it is a little bit beyond the norms. I don't see the United States, despite what Edward Snowden will tell you, I don't see them going out and hacking into companies and trojaning updates and things like that. That's why we saw, you know, incredibly elaborate MD5 collision attacks performed by presumably NSA or Cyber Command against Microsoft Update back in the sort of Stuxnet days, right? So yeah, I can see why they want to push back against these particular means, if not the ends. There's also a line in this article that suggests that one of the reasons the United States wants to apply sanctions is because Russia provides safe haven to cyber criminals, right? Which is something listeners would have heard us talk about on the show previously.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that certainly makes a lot of sense. The cybercrime angle clearly is a really big deal, especially with the amount of ransomware and especially with, you know, the impact that we've seen with that ransomware during the pandemic period. Like, that's absolutely a message that needs to be sent. And, you know, I think your points around the methods being of concern, and there's a bit of back and forth in the piece about, you know, whether this was indiscriminate or whether it was targeted.
Yeah,
whether it was sufficiently discriminate.
I think some of that's a bit dumb, to be honest. Like people saying, oh, this could have been incredibly destructive. Well, anything could have been incredibly destructive, right? Like,
exactly right. Yeah. You can use these things for whatever purpose you choose, and no one can tell in advance what that's going to be, right? You break into a bunch of stuff to prepare the battle space, right?
But that said, I mean, I do understand why you would want to send a message that this sort of thing isn't on, because you do not want to undermine confidence in the supply chain and things like software updates. And it's not because of that usual trope about, oh, well, people won't run updates. They will. You know, my concern is more that people are going to have to start spending gargantuan amounts of money to prepare themselves against this type of thing, right? And that's just probably not where we want to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's about making an ecosystem that's kind of safe to operate in, right? And attacking supply chain is a thing that, you know, absolutely works, which is why people are doing it. And we've had enough success in the rest of the kind of direct security industry that we're pushing people into supply chain. But there's just a whole bunch of complexities in, you know, doing security right in supply chain, and cost is clearly one of them. But I mean, also things like, you know, how does pen testing work across supply chain boundaries? And the answer is it doesn't, right? Nobody else other than real attackers can do those kinds of attacks to show the impact and to kind of look for ways to address them from a technical perspective. So, you know, there's just it's a very much a can of worms that no one really wants to open, I think. And that's the kind of message the US is trying to say. Although, you know, it's also not, you know, you can't say that the US has never done this kind of thing themselves. I mean,
I struggle to think of a case study. Have you got one?
Well, I mean, I was thinking about the Crypto AG example.
Oh, right, but that was they founded that company.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, like, this is a different kind of supply chain, but I mean, and it's certainly more targeted in that the customers of that organization were, you know, targeted. But yeah, you know, there are certainly lots of ways to, you know, skin the supply chain cat.
I don't think that's comparable. I see why you'd bring it in. It was also quite a long time ago. I mean,
Well, it lasted a very long time as well.
Yeah, it did. They actually turned a buck on that, which is also...
I mean, that's the best sort of supply chain, one where you actually make money in the process.
Espionage that makes money without stealing Bitcoin. So very, very nicely done. But look, we've dropped a link into the Washington Post yarn. That one's by Ellen Nakashima. And, you know, I suspect we'll see more details on this sort of fleshed out over the next week or two. So, yeah, we've just been speculating mostly, which is of limited use. So let's move on. But apparently, yeah, NASA and the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, they were targeted during the SolarWinds campaign, the Holiday Bear campaign, although we are specifically talking about the SolarWinds bit. An interesting thing, though, is that, yeah, Holiday Bear, SVR, apparently got their mitts on some pretty decent Microsoft source code, right? So I think we saw early reports that maybe they got access to some of the ADFS source code, but it looks like there was a bit more to it than that, according to this report from Joseph Mann at Reuters.
Yeah, the reporting says that Microsoft found evidence that the attackers had rummaged in the code repos for some of the Azure, like, cloud identity plumbing, some bits of Exchange, and some things related to the Intune mobile device management. Microsoft's blog post kind of suggests that they were looking for credentials. Like, it reads like they've had the search history for them rummaging in the repos. It didn't exfil the whole set of source, but they were using the built-in search tools to be able to rummage, and that they were able to recreate what they were looking for. Microsoft says that it didn't actually store any credentials in the source trees and they didn't get anything of value, but, you know, maybe they're still investigating. And, you know, anytime an attacker can go look at, you know, how identity works in a platform like Azure, that's going to be really useful, I'm sure.
Turning our attention to France, and we spoke about that company Centrion, that apparently there was some sort of supply chain attack against them. We got some more details here, and they are interesting. Apparently, only 15 entities were targeted through this attack, and the only thing the attackers had actually subverted was some, like, ancient, no longer supported free open source version of their product. So not as much of a big deal as initially thought. Where it gets interesting, though, is they say they have evidence linking this to the Sandworm crew at Russia's GRU.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting combination, right, where, you know, attacking a bunch of really old open source versions of this thing, you know, backdooring a bunch of open source versions of the software that's used by a small group of people, which doesn't seem very exciting, and then combining it with, you know, kind of post-intrusion backdoors that are only used by Sandworm crew.
It's like finding out that Mike Tyson picked a fight with a random 9-year-old, you know? Like, it's just, it's why?
It is a little weird, but then, hey, you know, we have seen, you know, Sandworm's done a lot of you know, pretty nasty things, but we, you know, we have seen them also going around, you know, just popping XM servers on the internet and for
shiggles.
Sometimes you don't know where you're going to get until after you've shelled a bunch of stuff, and then you can decide what you're going to use it for. But yeah, it's certainly an interesting combination.
Now, this next story is really interesting. We're going to link through to Catalan's version of it. FireEye has dropped a report linking the attacks against Excellion FTA to Fin11, which is a group that in turn is linked to Clop. Now, this story actually mentions Risky Beers because Brett Winiford, who writes our newsletter, he was actually the first to break the Clop angle. And he's certainly fleshed out this story over a couple of months. You know, he brought it to me and he said, look, this is bigger than the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and the couple of targets that had been named in it. Yeah, I mean, we've got Bombardier, Singtel, all these giant companies have just been completely rinsed. And now their data is being published on the Clop ransomware site. And FireEye has linked the activity to Fin11.
Yeah, they've got some suggestion that the tooling used during exploitation, which they've kind of clustered together as one group, and the process of doing the ransomware, you know, as the kind of Clop leak site, both of the sets of infrastructure and approaches there do overlap with things they've seen Fin11 doing in the past. So that's an interesting kind of piece of attribution. And certainly as, you know, ransomware operations go, like this idea of just moving to straightforward, just stealing the data and skipping the whole encrypting it step, you know, the fact that that's tied back to financial crime organizations that have a bunch of other history doing this kind of thing. The past does suggest the evolution of the business model, which, you know, we're always in favor of around here.
Excellion's press release on this is absolutely hilarious. They should just shut up, because they said out of approximately 300 total FTA clients, fewer than 100 were victims of the attack. So like one in three of our customers of that particular product line got owned. One in three that you know about, and you're putting that in your press release. Yeah, exactly. And they're saying within this group, fewer than 25 appear to have suffered significant data theft. The word appear is doing a lot of heavy lifting there, dude. A lot of heavy lifting. So yeah, look, it is every bit as bad as we've been saying. And, you know, now we've got the FireEye report to prove it. Now, weird one from Andy Greenberg over at Wired, based on some checkpoint research, looking at a tool used by Chinese APT crews. I'll let you walk us through this one because, yeah, there's a bit to talk about here.
So the story goes, in 2017, Lockheed Martin found some Chinese attackers using a local Prevesk tool, which was then kind of attributed to APT 31. That tool, Microsoft went around and fixed the bug that it was exploiting. And then at some point later on, Checkpoint were building a bunch of fingerprints for exploit tools and vulnerabilities that they could use for something. And they were going through a bunch of old Windows Prevesks. And their tool matched this particular thing that Lockheed Martin had found, not with a Chinese APT 31, but with a bug, with a tool released in the Shadow Broker's dump of Equation Group tools. And so looking at the dates on those, it looks like the Chinese at some point in the early 2010s either nicked or obtained the technique from this Equation Group tool, repurposed it, and then started using it themselves to ESCPRIV on Windows boxes.
Well, I mean, that's the sort of thing that happens, right? But I mean, this write-up sort of implies that it's possible that somehow the Chinese got access to NSA tools, right? Like from NSA. But really, you're reading this and you're thinking, well, it's a Prevesk, so it's going to hit the disk, right? So it's going to be easy to capture. Probably someone got it that way. I mean, am I crazy or is that like the most likely scenario here?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a bunch of ways that, you can get hold of without knowing the specifics of the bug, right? I mean, there's a bunch of things that could have happened, right? I mean, they absolutely could have shelled the NSA and stolen their tools. They could have shelled one of the kind of, you know, operational jump boxes that had some tools staged on them, or they could have had their own privs esked, and then they're rolling incident response and they find either evidence of the tooling or they find, you know, some logs or something that tip them off to the, you know, the nature of the bug and they're able to reproduce it. So, yeah, there's a, you know, every time you use a bug, you know, you certainly risk having it burnt, you know, by the people you're attacking or by a vendor or by some other telemetry that you don't even know about. Sorry, I mean, there's lots of ways to lose this stuff, and that's part of the, you know, equities calculus, how we need to try and decide what to go use on an operation. But yeah, the piece does kind of lean towards the, oh my God, maybe the Chinese shadow brokered, you know, the NSA.
Yeah,
before
and
shadow
they're like, oh, they had to have hands-on access to the Equation Group's compiled program. And it's like, well, that wouldn't be very hard if you're rolling incident response where that tool was used, right? Like, and they also say, oh, there were, you know, parts that they of the code that they copied that didn't really do anything, that shouldn't have really been there. So clearly it was just copied. Okay, we get it. It was copied from an Equation Group tool. But like, that's not proof of really that much, okay? When you're talking about a local Prevesk tool that is going to be on the box that you're Prevesking.
Yeah, I mean, certainly even from a, you know, statistical point of view, like the amount of times that Chinese boxes have been Prevesked by NSA versus the amount of times that the Chinese are inside the NSA stealing their tools, you know, like weighted probabilities
probably
there's
a bit
the
of
former.
An imbalance there. Yeah, yeah. I'm with you there. But I mean, could it have been possible that someone, you know, captured the binary and then just sliced out the good bit and wedged it into a different, you know, a different binary?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, there may have been, you know, if, for example, it's a memory corruption, you know, like stealing a ROP chain or stealing some kind of, you know, heap massaging or, you know, whatever kind of thing makes the bug work. Sometimes, you know, it just makes sense to nick that without, you know, going through the process of figuring out exactly how it works and then, you know, just making a different one just for the sake of being different. I mean, there's plenty of, you know, reasons why you may as well just go use it. And who knows, often there's benefits to stealing other people's tools and using them, you know, regardless of by what mechanism you get them, from muddying the attribution waters to, you know, being whitelisted perhaps. You're not getting, you know, not triggering defensive stuff. Like, you know, who knows, there's lots of benefits.
Yeah, I guess what we're saying here, though, is that while it is possible that Chinese super cyber soldiers somehow infiltrated NSA, it's probably more likely someone just was doing Prevesk using lazy mode, you know, by stealing something that popped up in IR.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, probably a more likely thing, and certainly a good reminder that everyone who works in IR, like, every one of those things is a gift. You're getting giving a free bug. You should be very thankful.
Now, speaking of all things China, blew me away, this headline, just totally unexpected, but the Biden administration has hit the old pause button on the US government's plans to ban WeChat and TikTok. I think, you know, if I had to guess, they're probably going to be looking at introducing some more comprehensive reform along the lines of what Alex Stamos has mentioned on this show before about sort of, you know, data sovereignty rules and things like that, basically a US GDPR, which can help with some of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's in the end what America needs more than knee-jerk reactions to TikTok is, you know, a more comprehensive, understood framework that, you know, doesn't just solve the problems in terms of international relationships, but also solves, you know, a bunch of the other privacy and data and, you know, kind of all of the other bits and pieces that have been so difficult, you know, in terms of, you know, advertising telemetry and the other kind of, you know, the way the amount of data that gets sprayed around the place. So a more comprehensive solution totally makes more sense. I had actually forgotten until I reread this piece because, like, internet time is so fast and this piece seems...
Well, internet,
you know,
time in the
ago.
Age of Trump, though, as well, right? Like, it was just everything was happening so fast. God. Yeah.
But, I mean, just the idea that we were ever at a point in life where they were going to forcibly sell TikTok to Oracle to improve its security. Like, that was a concept. Just, yeah, yeah, made me laugh out loud in the office, actually. That was,
yeah, selling it to Oracle, maybe not as good a plan. We got a couple of indictments of, you know, all these North Korean Lazarus crew people who are creating, like, Bitcoin-related software. Like, you know, here's a Bitcoin client. It's free. It works really well. And it turns out, like, the thing was basically just trojaned by the people who created it. We got some detail, more detail on the Lazarus crew, including an indictment. We got some chain analysis detail about the amount of money North Korea has stolen in crypto. It's like up to $1.75 billion with a B these days. Fun stuff.
Yeah, it's good to see this kind of carrying onwards. I mean, obviously, they're not going to get anyone out of North Korea, you know, just indicting them, probably not a whole bunch of use. But, you know, having some data to point out and say, like, kind of how much money we're talking, and obviously, you know, the range of what they have tried to steal, you know, in the billion and change to what they've actually managed, and chain analysis's work is interesting because we do get to see some, you know, kind of numbers that are a bit more directly saying, you know, that this actually got into North Korea through their, you know, their approach to mixing it through the currency networks. But, I mean, the fact that we're talking, you know, in the order of $1 billion when their GDP is, you know, somewhere between 20 and 40 billion, depending on, you know, whether you believe the South Koreans or the World Bank or whoever, you know, that's a really significant part of the economy to fund. And that is, you know, from a threat modeling point of view, the fact that there is a national economy that's funded on, you know, stealing Bitcoin from Elon Musk or whatever, like, that's a thing you probably need to take into account, you know, in your threat model, you know, if you're holding a whole bunch of crypto.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And yeah, you better manage that carefully, for sure. Now, Adam, I want to talk about a blog post that you actually sent me. It was just after we recorded the last show a couple of weeks back. This is the blog post by Alex Bersan, and it's about dependency confusion. It's very interesting and alarming and all sorts of fun. Please walk us through it.
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece of research that looked at, you know, open source supply chain through software repositories and the way that they're used, you know, during the build process when people are compiling their software and building their virtual machines and Docker containers and whatever else these days. And the key insight of this research is that there's a lot of people who have internal code repositories that maintains their kind of proprietary secret source, and then they use a whole bunch of upstream open source stuff from, you know, the Node NPM or from Python PyPy or whatever other, you know, package repos. And this research looked at what happens when you have name collisions between things that are in the private repo and things that are in the public repo. And what he found was that in many cases, the software build pipeline doesn't care. Like, there's no independent namespace for an internal repository. So if you have a package called the same thing in a public repo, in a public source, that has a higher version number than what you have in your internal one, then chances are it's going to use the one from the outside source and you can inject into the build process. And
But that's fine, Adam, because how on earth is anyone going to find out what these private repo names are? These private library names are?
Yeah, I mean, that is essentially the, you know, the obscurity there is what you're relying on. And actually, he goes through in his blog post some of the techniques for spotting those names, like looking in build logs, looking in, you know, in the software sources or in the compiled artifacts to figure out what those internal names are. And actually then went through and submitted a bunch of bug bounties and things, made a bit of money out of it, which is good. And yeah, ended up popping shells and Apple and Microsoft and all sorts of people. So yeah, we've seen some response to that. Microsoft put out a white paper describing this particular issue and that people need to watch out for it. We've seen a bunch of packages in the Python repo that looked like they were doing this kind of thing already, with, although not necessarily with malicious payloads. And yeah, I mean, it's a thing that if you are looking after a whole bunch of products being built, you know, thinking big vendors that are building embedded software, or you know, anyone that's got a lot of software being built that uses open source stuff, like, this is almost certainly going to be a, you know, a thing that impacts you. And like, solving this is going to be fiddly.
Well, I was going to say, right, like, it's not like it's an easy solution, which is you just get it to default to your own copies of things, right? Because the reason it wants the latest version, that's a good reason, right? Because you want to get the freshest copies of things where bugs have been fixed. So if you just change the behavior to default to preference local over remote, you're just going to wind up with ancient rotting software being spat out by your build process.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a couple of scenarios, and that's one of them, where you've forked an outside library and you're maintaining it internally with some particular changes. And in that sense, yeah, you don't get the upstream security patches or whatever else coming along. So that's certainly one of the problems, where just blindly using your internal version forever is going to cause you issues. But there's also plenty of places that might include, you know, local configuration, have local software components that, you know, site locals, you know, config stuff or whatever else that, you know, just happens to have a package name called, you know, like site config or something like that. And someone can go make that upstream and just straight up inject code into your build. Like, that's a situation where you always want to prefer the internal. So the solutions are not just like, you know, press one button. I think, for example, the Python packaging, they've changed some of the behavior of how the commandlet arguments with specify repositories work. But yeah, it's a solution you have to think about, not just, you know, do exactly what the advisory says and forget about it.
Yeah, it's funny that Microsoft was the one company that, like, shit bricks and then pumped out a bunch of info on this, because they were like, yeah, they were on top of it. They recognized that it's a thing.
Yeah, the Microsoft certainly builds a lot of software, and, you know, there's just a whole bunch of developers building a whole bunch of stuff using Microsoft tooling. And I imagine they looked at that and went, well, crap.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's going to get a lot of things shelled.
Yeah. Speaking of Microsoft, they have pushed an update out to Win 10, which is like forcibly removing, it's a mandatory update that forcibly removes Flash from Windows computers, which is good. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, Adobe had already kind of killed it with their own, you know, time bomb, so it makes sense that Microsoft would get rid of it. And this is one of those patches that you've been able to, like, install yourself optionally if you wanted, but yeah, pushing it down, scrubbing Flash from the face of the internet seems like, you know, seems like good work.
Well, from the face of the English-speaking internet, because, look, some people might not know this, but you can still get Flash in China. There is so much Flash in China that, like, just completely squashing it, that was not an option. So it is still supported in China. Now, according to this piece, I thought it was supported by Adobe, but apparently it's actually supported by some Chinese company, you know, that does the local customizations. Now it's actually doing browser pop-ups with ads, like the official Flash, which is just so, like, it's the sort of thing that Flash should be doing when you think about it, because it's just such trash software that for it to do this extra trashy thing kind of feels right.
Yeah, no, it is a pretty unique situation to have the only legit, you know, worldwide distributor of Flash dropping backdoored versions, or dropping versions with malware in anyway. But hey, I mean, this is you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people over in, you know, in Fort Meade and else that's tasked with breaking into stuff in China that's just, you know, kind of quietly sitting there golf clapping and enjoying the availability of Flash in China.
The most amazing thing about Flash being a China-only piece of software now, which is full of, you know, riddled with bugs, is, you know, no VEP problems there, no vulnerabilities equity process problems there. It's like Flash, Chinese Flash is basically like the cyber equivalent of a free fire zone. Just go for your life.
Exactly. And I mean, like, apropos of our earlier conversation about supply chain, like, this is one of the ways that you solve supply chain, is by cutting the supply chain in half and having a, you know, US-centric supply chain and a, you know, China-centric supply chain, and
managed by an American company, like, which is just the icing on the cake, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of irony there.
Now, you might remember Brian Krebs wrote a bunch of stories, I think in 2015, about this Romanian skimmer gang that was operating in Mexico. It was just fantastic stuff. This was a story that earned him a whole bunch of death threats, right? But it's just one of those absolutely bonkers, amazing Brian Krebs stories. We got an update on that, and it is equally wild.
Yes, according to the story, the leader of the Green Ecologist Party of Mexico was dismissed after it turned out that one of his bank accounts was one of the ones seized for handling the proceeds of this particular ATM skimming operation, along with other, you know, kind of local dignitaries in the region over the years since that story broke, which is, yeah, I mean, it's not ideal when you've got your, you know, elected politicians involved in ATM skimming.
Well, I mean, given it's Mexico and what's going on there with a lot of the crime and corruption, like, this is kind of at the soft end, I would have thought, but it's still bonkers. Like, Brian actually went to Mexico and wandered around with a cheap phone with like a Bluetooth scanner on it and stuff to spot some of these Bluetooth skimmers. And look, it's just a crazy story. You can click through and read it in this week's show notes, but yeah, wow. Proofpoint is suing Facebook. Facebook has been squashing lookalike domains, which is a good thing, and it's something that we've spoken about. Yes. Yeah, they're really activating the lawyers and getting them to go out there and squash all this stuff. That's great, but they actually squashed some of Proofpoint's like phishing training domains, which is like facebook-login.net and whatever. They had a few of them and, you know, they've been kind of seized. So now Proofpoint's suing to get them back.
It's pretty funny. And to be fair, like, if I was Proofpoint, I would be pretty salty about losing some of these because they've got some good stuff. They have Instagarn. Like,
yeah, Instagarn. Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, one.
That's pretty good. Instagarn.
No, it was Instagram.
Instagram,
so the
yeah,
R and the N looks like an M. No, I noticed they got some great domains, but yeah. I think this is interesting, right? Because, you know, this is almost like a fair use argument, but for a trademark instead of copyright. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
I found it interesting.
Yeah, Proofpoint's argument is that they are using them in good faith, right? That they're not misrepresenting themselves as Facebook or Instagram, right? If you go to the page independently, then you just get a, hey, this is Proofpoint. And obviously, if they're sending phishing training emails, it's authorized and all that kind of thing. So that's their argument. We'll see whether or not they get their sweet domains back from Facebook's lawyers or not. I don't know.
Yeah, that's I mean, yeah, the lawyers will win this one, basically.
Exactly, yes. Sport. It's the winner on the day.
But yeah, Instagram.com. I'd love that one. Yeah, yeah.
Whoever did that at Proofpoint, that was a good day.
Because you're only a couple of pixels off, really, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, and some people just, you know, have naturally bad kerning in their eyes. You know, it's makes a lot of sense.
You mean bad chemming?
Exactly. Bad chemming, yes. Bad chemming.
There's a bit of Mac malware going around. It's hit like 30,000 Macs. It's not really that interesting, I guess. But what is interesting is no one really knows what this malware is trying to do. And like, some of the binaries that are included it with are like Hello World binaries. Like, it just really looks like someone developing it in the wild. A lot of the reports on this thing have made a big deal out of the fact that it's compiled for M1 chips, which I don't really see as like that interesting, but am I missing something?
Apple's compiler tools are pretty good at that kind of thing. You know, that's just a push boot and receive new binary.
Well, that's why I'm like, why is this a big deal? Everyone's like, oh, Apple's new architecture hit by malware. And I'm like, do you know how compilers work?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, not a lot of people compile software and compile malware, I guess. Maybe it seems magical. Everyone's seen, like, the visual virus builders that you get in, like, you know, Lawnmower Man in the movies or whatever.
Yeah, so maybe.
I think it's like that. It takes a whole bunch of...
Apparently, like, the way that they've built the M1 chip, like, yeah, compiling for it is very, very easy. But anyway, what do we know about this malware?
Well, that's the thing. It's not a whole bunch, right? We know that there's a bunch of Macs that have been infected with it. We don't know how they got it. And we don't know what it does. Like, it doesn't appear to have any payload modules yet. It's only got, as you said, dummy ones that are just kind of there to, you know, as placeholders.
So reassuring all round.
Well, yeah. Like, could be doing something. But yeah, we don't really know what it's for. And as you say, it could be, you know, people doing it live, you know, making it up as they go along. And, you know, we'll find out what the payload is when they finish minimum viable payload.
Building malware in prod. Shout out to Red Canary, the team there who unearthed that one. Apple is introducing more memory mitigations into iOS 14.5, according to this story from Lorenzo and Joe, double byline, over at Vice Motherboard.
This is where Apple is adding their pointer authentication process to a particular set of pointers in the binaries that it wasn't previously used for, that a bunch of the exploits that did you know, kind of memory corruption leading the code exec were using. So it's kind of just squashing a particular exploitation technique. A bunch of exploit devs are on the record talking to Vice, saying that that makes them sad and that it's going to make life more difficult, and presumably it ruined a bunch of bugs that people had on the shelf. So.
But that's like, I don't know how many exploit writers you know these days, but that's like every time you ask him, how are you? That's basically the conversation. Like, and it has been for the last 5 years. They always get super salty when Apple introduces a new mitigation. So they're mad about it for like 2 months until they figure out how to sidestep it, and then they shut up again. But
it's such a rollercoaster life being an exploit dev.
Oh man, it would be horrible. Like honestly, it would be really, really stressful. Which is good. Well,
yeah, exactly right. It is good, and I feel bad because a bunch of those people are my friends. But yeah, it's just not. It's not the late 90s, early 2000s. The stuff is not easy, and probably not a lot of fun anymore.
In other news, spammer want IP.
Yes, someone has been credential stuffing against the RIPE NCC registry that's responsible for allocation of IPv4 and IPv6 address space in Europe and the Middle East. And I guess they probably got some accounts. IP address space is pretty valuable these days.
RIPE are saying they foiled it completely, you know. But you might want to turn on 2FA, and it's like, so just let that sink in, everybody. IP allocations are not protected by multi-factor authentication by default.
And like, there's nothing useful that you can do if you can jack somebody else's address space. Like, nothing at all is useful for that.
But come on, this is just going to be spammers stealing a chunk of IPs to do a run, and they'll have it for a couple of days and then they'll lose it. Because these days you can't just take over whole chunks of IPv4 space, right, and keep them in perpetuity.
Yeah,
you used to be able to do that. Like, people, spammers would take over. They'd just steal huge IP ranges and they'd have them for like 10 years before anybody noticed.
Yeah, it certainly has gotten a bit harder these days to have, you know, nasty, swampy address space routed into strange places of the internet. Much as many of us would actually like that. I mean, you know, I could do with some more V4. That would be lovely. I looked at this and I'm like, damn, maybe I should have done that. I could have used some more address space. But yeah, it is much more difficult these days to keep that under the radar.
A bunch of lawmakers in the United States is demanding answers from the Department of Defense in the US about how they used the data that they purchased from, you know, one of those tracking companies. This was a whole thing. We spoke about it a few times. It was reporting from Vice Motherboard that brought it to light. The US military was buying data from these Muslim apps, like tracking data or from apps targeted towards Muslims. I mean, I'm guessing given it's the US military and they operate in some countries where there are a lot of Muslims, that would make sense as the use case, right? Like it's sort of a bit of a cheat for doing certain types of tracking. But now some US politicians want to ask some pointed questions about whether or not any US citizens were affected by this. And I think the likelihood of that is, I'm guessing, pretty slim. But I also think it's very good that someone's going to ask that question, because there needs to be some accountability here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good example of kind of unintended consequences in a way of having this kind of, you know, surveillance capitalism future that we live in, and how that interacts with them being used by governments and militaries and other things like that. You know, this is a thing that is applicable, you know, much more widely than this particular example. And I think the solutions, you know, and the fact that this discussion is happening is really good, because the solutions we have to go towards, you know, do need to be more widespread, right, than just this particular, you know, this particular group or sets of individuals being targeted by the military. And, you know, the kind of wider conversation about privacy and surveillance capitalism and how that all works, and primarily in the US, because obviously, you know, Europe's kind of gone down that road with GDPR, and a bunch of other jurisdictions, you know, have made their own kind of ideas about how this should work. But the US is just such a big part of the tech ecosystem that for it to be the kind of weird free-for-all still that it is there, you know, just kind of makes everyone else's lives miserable as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Moving on to some tech news, and Bind has implemented DNS over HTTPS, which, I mean, at this point, it's a done deal, right? Like, that's it. It's the default name server. Now the default name server is going to support it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not a surprise to anybody. Certainly my first reaction reading this was, Lord, the last thing the Bind code base needs is a web server built into it. But, you know, I'm sure it's been reviewed and I'm sure it's all right.
But it wouldn't need to be a particularly complicated web server, so there's that.
Well, no, but I mean, still, like, you get the, you know, complicated thing like building a web server. You know, even a simple web server is a complicated thing, and you're going to get a complicated thing, you know, wrong the first 17 times you implement it. So it did make me feel a little bit squiffy, but it is essentially a done deal. Like, when we've got widespread implementations of DNS over TLS, which was already in Bind, and now DNS over HTTPS, makes sense.
Parler, the very far right wing social media network that has been scrubbed from Apple and Google's app stores, it got kicked off Amazon, and they had a big cry about how the internet, you know, there's no freedom of speech. Well, they are back online. I mean, 8chan came back after Cloudflare got rid of them, but the time that they were down certainly disrupted that site. Now Parler is back as well. So I think we could burst this bubble that just because you can't get on AWS means you kicked off the internet.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how long they last, of course, and whether or not, you know, not building on top of AWS's, you know, kind of set of building blocks, you know, means that they're still capable of building a site that can scale and function. But, you know, that's, I guess, another set of problems they've got. But yeah, I mean, they're being hosted by an American company serving American net blocks, right? It's not like they've run off to, you know, some other foreign jurisdiction. So yeah, it does take, a bit of the wind out of the sails of that argument.
Apparently it's a pretty rough neighborhood, though, where they are.
Oh, like yeah.
I think the arguments around the being booted out of app stores, I mean, I think that's to a degree a more valid argument when it comes to the freedom of speech stuff. But also, I think those are companies that they just might not want to have their brands associated with this sort of content, which is also fair enough. What's going to really change this whole equation is when portable web applications become more of a thing and app stores are less important. I mean, would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's, you know, part of the value proposition for Apple is selling devices that are tied to their ecosystem and with a, you know, curated environment. And yeah, if, you know, as things are more usable in web browsers and, you know, having standalone applications is less important, you know, from terms of being able to deliver service, maybe it's a bit clumsy to use, but you can still deliver a service through a web app, then yeah, the platform vendors do lose some of the teeth that are available to them. Although obviously, you know, Apple in particular is, you know, certainly trying to build their business around maintaining control of their devices. You know, Google a bit more free-for-all. But yeah, it is a bit different when it's just a web app and a website versus, you know, yeah, a mobile app that's been through some kind of vetting process.
Yeah, it is, right? So I don't know. I just sort of think medium term, I wonder how that's going to play out, right? Because PWA with an icon, I mean, it's an app, right? Let's be honest. What else have we got here? Yeah, some Android app called ShareIt, which apparently has 1 billion downloads. So I'm going to say that it's a popular app. They had a bug reported to them via Trend Micro, and they sat on it for a long time. And by the looks of things, pretty bad bug.
Yeah, this is an app for sharing files between devices and between people, and apparently there was a bunch of bugs where, like, if you can get on the network in the middle, or if you're another app running on the same device and you can access the, like, temporary directory, the shared file system components, then you can leverage that into kind of passing commands to the app and then, you know, go on with Stacodec and stealing the data out of the app can access, that kind of thing. So pretty bad. It was reported to the vendor of this application, who I guess just didn't respond. They sat on it for 3 months and have now dropped the details. The vendor, of course, now apparently is patching it. Yeah, pretty classic reason why full disclosure was invented.
Yes, exactly. Yandex says it caught an employee selling access to users' inboxes. And then you're like, oh, that sucks. And then you see that they sold access to 4,887 user accounts. That's bad.
It's really not ideal. And that's, you know, certainly in the threat model of any sufficiently large, you know, cloud organization to worry about rogue employees being paid off to do bad things. And yeah, that's quite a lot of people's email accounts.
You would think they might have caught it maybe after the first few hundred. I don't know.
You'd hope.
So that's Russia's Google, basically, Yandex, for those of you who are not aware. But yeah, you would like to think that if something like that happened at Google, they would pick it up a little bit quicker.
Yeah, well, you would hope.
Yeah. There's been a bunch of arrests around, you know, SIM swappers. Same sort of thing, corruption, right? Like always these SIM swapping crews are paying someone at a telco to help them commit these crimes. And what's really frustrating is when you read the charging details. Yeah, so here it is. Stephen Daniel DeFiore of Brandon, Florida. So he is Florida man. He received $2,325 between October 2018 and November 9, 2018. $2,000? To do this? I mean, what's wrong with these people?
It does seem pretty bargain basement, but I mean, that's the really sobering bit about this is that you spend so much on, you know, on security and 2FA and all of these other controls, and yet, you know, some Florida man working at a telco will sell you out for, you know, $100 a head. Because he said, 20, 19 people's accounts and he made 2,300. Yeah, so like $100 a head. Like, that's not a big investment for an attacker, and especially in this case when the, you know, sim swappers are going after, you know, people with, you know, Bitcoin whales and all that kind of thing, which they'll make real return on. Yeah, that's depressing.
Yeah, and this one of the victims had a significant portion of their holdings stolen, and you know, you just sort of think
maybe shouldn't have hodled, but you know.
Well, or maybe shouldn't have used SMS 2FA, but I mean, that's a whole other conversation we don't have time for. But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This one's interesting. Closer to home, you know, obviously years ago we spoke about the introduction of Australia's, mandatory data retention regime, which was very controversial at the time for a whole bunch of reasons that we're not going to get into. One of the things that happened through that is the scheme actually got tightened up a little bit, but unfortunately, various police forces kind of forgot to tell their staff, right? So what we've got here is a situation where it turns out like a lot of personnel are pretty much routinely breaking the law when they're accessing Australians' metadata. So there's been a bit of a review and they're recommending some training. I just thought this was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly good to see the oversight process kind of working like it should, right? Going back, reviewing what particular law enforcement organizations, you know, went off and looked at, whether they did it correctly, whether they got rid of the data correctly, whether they audited it correctly, and then kind of telling them off and giving them, a bunch of recommendations on things that they should do to be able to be allowed to continue to have this access.
Some high decibel guidance, I think, is what they would have received after this.
But yeah, it's also useful to see kind of what the scale is, you know, number of agencies, you know, how much information they're getting, that kind of thing. So yeah, like, this is oversight, you know, kind of working like it should.
Yeah, but they really need to take the training thing seriously, because it's not good when you've got the cops breaking the law, right? And I know, look, it's not the worst infraction in the world, but like, you need to dot your I's and cross your T's when you're dealing with this sort of information.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where you've got, you know, a lot of responsibility having that access, and you have to take that responsibility seriously.
Now, we spoke 2 weeks ago about this CypherGate crappy, like, Italian copware, which was trying to, like, get people to manually install MDM profiles under the guise that's how you get WhatsApp to work and whatever. Apparently, prosecutors in Italy, and this is another one from Lorenzo over at Vice, apparently prosecutors in Italy have said, like, stop using it immediately, because apparently when cops tried to, like, do some sort of operation which involved exfilling data off the target's device, like, it popped up some warning that was tipping them, and, like, it just doesn't sound like this is very good software.
It does not sound like it's good software. That's not really what you want, when you're in the middle of, you know, a sensitive, you know, drug cartel investigation, and then, yeah, it just pops up, would you like the cops to download your data? Yes, no.
That's not ideal. That's really, no, no.
No, cancel.
Imagine
cancel.
If the no's grayed out too, like, that'd be great. Oh, man.
I'm sure a lot of, you know, very florid Italian curse words were said at some point around then.
See. All right, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun, as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Haroon Mir of Thinks to Canary. Canary makes little honeypots you can use on your network to detect attackers. They have cloud versions as well. They're a really good idea and very well executed. And they're also priced surprisingly reasonably considering their usefulness. And you can check them out at canary.tools. And yeah, Haroon joined me to have a pretty wide-ranging conversation, actually. We started off by talking about how your security depends on your supplier's security. The SolarWinds poisoned update was proof of that. And then we moved on to talking about 1980s Australian government HIV awareness campaigns, oddly enough, hackers in your monitors, detection strategies, and more. Here's Haroon Mir.
So I absolutely agree that it's not just about SolarWinds, and it's in no way to give SolarWinds to let them off the hook, because I think they need to fix, like, their stuff. But I think in general, enterprise security sucks, and that includes the enterprises that are currently pumping out software. And so you get this horrible multiplier, because people's internal networks suck, and then they're pulling in software from people whose internal networks suck.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'm worried about is, like most of us have known it for years, right? Like, if you speak to anyone who's done pen testing, when we were at SensePost, like literally internal assessments were what you train the kids on, right? Like your big guns break into companies over the internet, break into applications, and you send the kids in for internals, and then they race for domain admin in a day because everyone's internal networks are terrible. Somehow, most enterprises don't know it or manage to forget it the day after they report. And so you get this pen test report or this internal analysis report that tells you that five strangers came in and within a week they were completely owned your network. And that doesn't raise enough bells to systemically fix things. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for it. And interestingly, I think some of the reasons are even funny. Like I think Microsoft and other big vendors who got spanked in the early 2000s fixing their stuff took away some of the impetus for people to fix their stuff.
Took away some of the panic, didn't it? It made people sort of calm down.
Exactly. It took away the worms that were wiping people out. And then it made people think things were getting better. But if you pull good security houses today, so not people who are taking...
No. I see where you're going with this. This whole thing is making me think of a series of HIV awareness... Bear with me here. HIV awareness TV ads that ran here in Australia, which was like two people in a bed, and they're saying, you know, you think you're just sharing your bed with this one person. And then it pans out and there's more beds with more people and more people. But you're sharing a bed with that person who's sharing their bed with that person, that person, that person. And then, you know, there's a lot of beds, right? That's kind of like enterprise soup these days, right? Is like your network, the security of your network kind of depends on the security of the networks of your suppliers. And that's...
Because you can never be sure just how many people you're really going to bed with.
That's sobering.
So that's a huge part of it. And then the other part that I've been hammering on for a few years now is, and a few people have spoken about it, the fact that we've got processes in everything. Like it was cool 10 years ago when you figured out you could own this crazy device that's on the network. Now, there's crazy devices in everything. Like the last few years of research have shown, like your monitor is an x86 computer, your microphone is running an embedded controller, your VGA adapter. So the number of places that a skilled attacker can hide once he owns you is so ridiculously great. And so if you start to add all those things up, you're saying, well, you really don't know where the attack's going to come from. Once an attack lands, there's an unlimited number of places the attacker can actually hide. Actually, you're in a pretty indefensible position. And again, like as terrible as it sounds, you underline all that with the fact that most enterprises somehow think they're doing okay. Like most of them won't say, actually, we 2 out of 10. Like most of them are like, yeah, we got spanked on the last pen test, but mostly we're doing better. You know, it's a process.
Look, I'm going to push back on the nihilism a little bit, right? Because sure. I did have to think through, like, everybody's thought through that scenario. Say you were a SolarWinds customer, you get popped, like, then what, right? And there are controls that would put you in a pretty good place. I mean, obviously, you want to talk about this because Canary is one of them, right? Like, it's not a control, it's a detection, but it would certainly be a useful thing to have in your network in that scenario. Some of the other people I work with, Airlock, right? They do allow listing. That second stage payload tried to spin up some unsigned DLLs. They would have caught that, right? So, I mean, there's two things right there. And then you look at like, okay, say they pop a service account, they start doing weird stuff with it. There are tools that will detect that.
Your guys would hopefully have seen them.
Yeah, so I think preventative controls, you know, generally are not going to be necessarily 100% effective, but you do have a lot of detection opportunities in that scenario.
So you're absolutely right. I'll submit that even though like lots of companies,
I'm not saying anybody actually does them, Haroon. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying it's possible, right?
Yeah. So that's the problem, and that's also one of the things that have kind of allowed enterprises to distract themselves. Like there's two very simple logic mistakes that lots of enterprises make. And it's going to sound extreme when I say it, but I'll say it anyway. For example, we did work many moons ago for this government network, and they believe themselves to be completely air-gapped, and so the air-gap solves all problems. And inside their network, you look at their antivirus console, because they still run antivirus. And literally that thing used to run like a slot machine, right? Like you'd just see the ticker going over with like viruses being picked up on workstations. And it's one of those times where people have kind of been conditioned to be okay with something where a single virus on a machine means that attacker code unexpectedly ran on a network where you expected no attacker code to run.
Oh, this is something that spun me out. I mean, I did a consulting gig like, geez, probably about a decade ago that was looking at, evaluating one AV package over another sort of thing. And, you know, when you realize that enterprises basically measure detection rates, like they measure the rate of malware in their organization, which means they're perpetually owned. Like that's sobering, right? When you realize that.
And that's much worse when you consider that we've gotten okay with calling it malware and watching their virus count go up. But if you just call it attacker code running on your workstation, like that should be a much bigger alarm. Like if Dan Gere says that like security is the lack of surprise, like that thing ticking over is very surprising. And somehow we've just gotten okay with it.
Yeah, like, but I mean, we're falling into the trap now of not even doing talking about security for the 1%, but about security for the 0.1%. Okay,
so
like this you're saying, well, this is our reality. Let's just reject it. I mean, how?
No. So it's very interesting. I think part of the problem we've had is looking at that stuff and going, well, it's hard. We should at least make incremental changes. And so then what you go is like, well, yesterday we had 10,000 of those. We'll be winning if after a year of effort we get 5,000 of those because we've driven it down. But I think for some of them, you've got to go, well, hold on. If we can't trust that anymore, we need a different plan. And for some of these things, you go, well, listen, if your monitor could be owning you and there's no way we're tagging all the monitors in this environment, then actually we need to just start looking at our data store and see who touches it.
Yeah.
Because we can't do this that way. And I think in some ways, because we kept looking at it incrementally and thinking, well, we'll just kick this down the road, it's better than nothing, it allowed us to do a lot of kicking that didn't go far down the road. And now that's created a whole bunch of busy work that we do because everyone knows that's the business of security.
Look, I think what you're saying is interesting, right? Because zero trust networks have been the buzzword for the last 5 years, but you know, you're kind of advocating for a zero trust endpoint model, which is harder and doesn't completely solve problems. But I get where you're coming from, I guess. Zero trust endpoints,
For the most part, what I'm going for is for people to recheck whether their assumptions hold based on the results. And that's why one of the rays of light that I think will come out of this whole debacle is more people should actually stop and ask, well, what happens to us if this AV server is compromised?
Yeah.
Like what happens to us if this thing is compromised? Because a little more thinking needs to go around that says, well, would we know?
Yeah, design for failure.
Nudge, nudge.
Nudge, nudge. Check out, canary.tools. But I think what you're saying, is you're advocating for people to, think a little bit more deeply about this and question some of those assumptions. Question whether or not, you know, living with rolling infections through your organization, like maybe you should operate under a different set of assumptions, seems to be what you're saying.
And I don't even think, like a long time ago, I said something where I said, like, I don't even think... Like if you've got a ridiculously massive network and you can come back and tell me, you know, by the time we start rolling out patches on the left, like the guys on the right have already rolled out of patch. Like, I think maybe you need to consider that patches are not your solution. Like maybe you need to find out how you can survive with unpatched machines. Like maybe your data is the stuff that needs protecting and your controls on that. But mainly, I think you sum it up right. it's time to rethink lots of that stuff. Because if you take the current position, and if most people ask this question that says, if my Orion server were hacking me internally, would I know and would I be able to stop it? And if the monitors from the help desk were attacking me, would I know and would I be able to stop it? And if the answers are no, those attacks are now in play. And actually, your answers need to take them into consideration.
But have we seen people's, you know, you keep using the example of monitors. I mean, is that something you've seen?
So NQ did a talk a few years back where
People have totally demoed it, right? But I'm just wondering if it's something that's been in the wild. I think it probably will be one day, but, you know.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. So I think we're now in the stage where lots of those attacks that were esoteric and reserved for Black Hat are now in play. Like I think with the industrialization of attack, it's much less, hey, this is cool and this is hard. It's now a question that says, okay, I can get you on that machine. I can get you on that network for 2 minutes. Where are you going to hide? And you give that to smart engineers and they'll give you a bunch of answers. So I think if you've got networks you care about, that stuff's now in play. Like one of the things I wrote about recently is like I'm calling it the Roger Bannister phenomenon, which is like before Bannister breaks the 4 minute mile, nobody, like everybody thinks it's ridiculously hard. And once he breaks it, like it's broken again within 50 days. And now school kids can run the 4 minute mile. And I think once attacks like SolarWinds make it into popular consciousness, a whole bunch of people go, oh, wait, totally. And that stuff just starts to become more real.
Well, Haroon Mir, I mean, you know, excellent philosophical chat as always. It's been great to see you. Great to catch up, my friend. And we'll be doing it again later on in the year. Cheers.
Sounds good. Thanks. Bye.
That was Haroon Mir there, and they are hosting a webinar called Detecting Attackers on Your Network Before They Dig In on March 4, and I've dropped a rego link into this week's show notes, and you can find it there. And you can check out Canary at canary.tools. But that is it for this week's show. I'll be back early next week with a soapbox edition of the show. I think that's with Jesse Rothstein from Extra Hop Networks. He was great last time, so you might want to check that one out. But until then, of course, I have been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.